Essentially, it's kind of like academic trolling of of my own scholarly community by pushing at the boundaries of what's considered acceptable behavior and trying to do things that are unacceptable, but that people don't want to tell you why it's unacceptable because they don't actually have a really good reason, right? So like a recent paper, a short essay I wrote was called A Legal Scholarship Jubilee, right? And what I did in that article was I offered to reattribute all of the law review articles that I'd previously written to other people for free. And so I had a whole bunch of people who would write in and say, I really like this article. Can it be mine now? And I say, absolutely. I'm going to reattribute that article to you. Now, obviously, I can't actually do that, right? Right? Like, norms of my profession don't permit me to reattribute things to other people once I've already published them. But then the question is, well, why not? Right? I mean, if I can ghostwrite them, am I allowed to ghostwrite them? People don't be, scholars don't like the idea of ghostwriting, right? But like, if it belongs to me, why can't I alienate it? Why can't I give it to someone else? no one really, I don't think anyone really has a good answer to that, other than that's like not part of our conventions.
I want to leap over buildings, want to fly over the shores, save the people from the villains, catch the crooks who rob the stores, write my name upon the sky, and when you call me, I'll be there, faster than a lightning flash, rushing through the cool night air. Oh, oh, so start ignition, count to zero. I just wanna be a superhero.
Hello, my darlings. Welcome to Titular Characters. I am the adorable Eva Webb, and today we're going to talk about plagiarism and maybe how to be a more effective iconoclast with scholar, superhero of academia, and really nice guy, Brian Fry. I'm super excited about this one, so I'm just going to dive right in. Brian, when we talk about plagiarism, what is actually being discussed?
I guess my inclination is to defer to the definitions, or in my opinion, the kind of lack of coherent definitions offered by the people who are objecting to something that they want to call plagiarism. So in my scholarship, I try to be as descriptive as possible when it comes to that. And I think one of the things that I've noticed in doing this research is the diversity of opinions and practices surrounding plagiarism norms and plagiarism rules in different discursive communities, which is a kind of a long and fancy way of saying that what plagiarism is, or what the word plagiarism is intended to mean, really depends on who you ask and when you ask it. Because I think that the term is very frequently twisted and reshaped to cover whatever kinds of practices a majority, or at least a kind of controlling group within a particular community, objects to and wants to prevent. And so my contention, anyway, in my scholarship, is that plagiarism norms in fact reflect the interests of the predominant members of a particular community or group that takes on for itself the authority to define and enforce plagiarism norms, and that fundamentally the origins of plagiarism norms and of the concept of plagiarism reflect economic interests of the people who are creating and enforcing those norms, rather than any sort of deontological moral value. But because people internalize, or have come to internalize, those norms so profoundly, they take on a kind of moral character that I argue they're they're not really entitled to have. That if you want to defend them, they should be defended on practical grounds, not on absolute moral grounds, because there's nothing intrinsically bad about copying without attribution. And in fact, in many contexts, even groups that purport to object to plagiarism still permit copying or use of words that are unattributed or improperly attributed, so long as they generate beneficial outcomes for the members of that group. And you know, the example I like to give there is authors in general will object quite strenuously to plagiarism, and yet everyone accepts ghostwriting as a perfectly acceptable, as a little, you know, perhaps a little disreputable, but obvious connection to plagiarism. In fact, it's literally plagiarism as defined by that particular community, but it's nonetheless accepted because it produces net benefits for authors, right? It's economically efficient for them. And I think that really underscores it, the kind of what I see as being hypocrisy, or at the very least the self-interest that's ultimately behind the way that communities conceptualize and define the concept of plagiarism.
When you see plagiarism happen, is the way that they tackle them always the same? Is it similar? Or would you say that they come up with different sorts of remedies based on the community and the time?
Yeah, I mean, very much the latter. And if I wanted to be cynical about it, I could say depending on who they're punishing and why as well. So I think it's very much the case that the consequences of perceived plagiarism very much depend upon the community in question. How they define plagiarism really depends on the community, and the consequences are also tied to other norms within that particular community. Although there's a substantial amount of bleed over among communities, and I think that ultimately leads to a lot of the problems that ultimately arise in the context of thinking about and enforcing plagiarism norms because of those differences in perspective. Right, when you have members of one group interacting with members of a different group and they have some degree of disagreement about what the norms should look like, right, that's a place where reaching a consensus can be a lot more difficult, right? But I would point, again, the example or the kind of the group that I've spent the most time talking about is kind of broadly speaking academic. And I would point that academic plagiarism norms are arguably better defined than plagiarism norms in other communities, which isn't saying much because I think they're still very poorly defined. Many schools adopt plagiarism policies that actually reading does very little to help you understand what you are and aren't supposed to be doing. And they also define plagiarism so capaciously, frequently, that I think it could encompass things that most people would be a little embarrassed to actually claim as plagiarism in the first place, right? So typically there's this idea that, well, plagiarism is any kind of unattributed copying, including the unattributed copying of an idea. Well, you know, I mean, that's theoretically true. I don't think that form of copying is usually actually seen as rising to the level that somebody might refer to it as plagiarism. Somebody might say, well, it's kind of derivative. But I think most people would be disinclined to think that, you know, you actually own the idea in some way such that you would have a kind of de facto property right to compel attribution of that idea to yourself. No, some people certainly do feel that way and get really angry if they feel like they deserve the citation that they didn't get, right? Of course, citation is the currency of the academic realm, and you know, people can be can get very upset if they don't receive the recognition they think they deserve. But I think that's sort of on the margins of what we actually call plagiarism, except perhaps when we're talking about the way we enforce plagiarism norms against students. And here is where I think it really gets more deeply to the question you were asking, at least as I understood it, right? The irony of academic plagiarism norms is that they were developed to reflect the expectations and practices of scholars, And yet they're enforced primarily against students and very junior scholars, and enforced much more rigorously against students and very junior scholars than they are against senior ones, right? So when there's a plagiarism scandal involving a senior scholar, it typically is embarrassing for everyone involved, and people come up with an acceptable excuse and then pretend like it never really happened, or they blame the carelessness of someone else and not the senior scholar, et cetera, et cetera. So it's, you know, it's a small s scandal that ultimately is an embarrassment, but doesn't have any real professional or personal consequences for the alleged plagiarist. By contrast, if it's a student, the level of charity shown towards students who are accused of plagiarism is shockingly low, and the consequences are shockingly severe. I mean, students are not infrequently suspended or expelled or get a black mark on their permanent record for having engaged in practices that, were it a senior scholar, historical practice suggests it would be, by contrast, a slap on the wrist. And I've always found that a little strange as well. I mean, shouldn't enforcement really go the other way around? I mean, after all, surely the senior scholars have a more developed and richer sense of what the norms and expectations in their professional field are, and also more familiarity with the kinds of practices that we're supposedly trying to teach, right? I mean, shouldn't students have at least an opportunity to make a mistake once in a while, or to misunderstand what expectations are? You know, shouldn't we be a little bit more accepting of that kind of, you know, learning what the norms are and perhaps making mistakes along the way, right? And also beyond that, you know, do we really think that these kinds of norms are appropriate for students in the first place? I mean, after all, there's a kind of assumption that prohibiting plagiarism is per se a good thing and per se associated with advancing the educational process. I find that really uncompelling and unconvincing. For two reasons. One, no one's actually produced any evidence to suggest that plagiarism norms advance learning. And second, I think there's every reason to think that plagiarism norms and the rigid enforcement of plagiarism norms actually are harm learning and are pedagogically unwise. I mean, after all, in basically every other creative context, we encourage copying as part of the learning process, right? If you go to art school and you're studying painting, right, copying the masters is a tried and true way of learning how to improve your painting skills. And, you know, copying other images is, you know, a way you learn how to create new images. Likewise, in music, that kind of pastiche and borrowing elements from different places and putting them together. I mean, again, that's also a tried and true method of learning how to produce music, not to mention, you know, performing music as well, right? So, I mean, if we think copying in other contexts is so closely tied to developing skills and understanding, it stands to reason that the same ought to be true in the context of writing. And yet we have this unique prohibition on copying as part of the pedagogical process when it comes to writing. I find that strange and unconvincing, especially in the absence of any evidence that it's actually effective from a pedagogical perspective, right? And I've looked at a lot of the literature on plagiarism. It's unbelievably unreflective, the typical literature on plagiarism. It just takes for granted that copying without attribution is a terrible, terrible thing. And yet, historically speaking, it was quite common until the modern era. And in fact, strongly encouraged. Coming up with new writing was seen as likely to be of lower quality than reusing material of known quality that had previously been produced. And the literature today simply just kind of takes for granted the idea that these norms that we've created and are enforcing are legitimate. It doesn't ask, you know, why they're legitimate. It doesn't ask what they're intended to actually accomplish. It just sees them as an end in themselves. And I think that's a mistake. And it's also like a category mistake, right? I mean, the same way as we think of copyright as, or at least in my mind, the way we properly think is of copyright protection as merely instrumental and a means toward achieving appropriate policy goals, so too should we be thinking about plagiarism norms as merely instrumental and as a means of achieving appropriate policy goals. And we should be asking whether or not they actually do achieve those goals.
So that's fascinating. Let's just see if I understand the concept of plagiarism. What you're talking about is words and expressions of ideas. And I think that that latter category is kind of a slippery slope, but words and expressions of ideas that one person came up with and another person borrows with that attribution. Is that correct?
I think that's a pretty standard definition. I think the kind of the core of the concept of plagiarism is copying without attribution, and what counts as copying and what's the relevant subject matter for a plagiarism claim, as it were. I think that's what varies from field to field, right? So some areas or some communities define plagiarism a lot more broadly to include a lot more kinds of copying than other ones do. But I think that the essence of plagiarism is copying without attribution.
I imagine that we have rules around plagiarism that sort of go above and beyond what copyrights provides for author protection. Why does this need to exist? Why do we need protections around the dissemination and transformation of these ideas that we're protecting in academia?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question, and I think it's hard to answer definitively. But my hypothesis would be that they developed or were developed by different groups of people in service of different ends. And so there are certain parallels between between copyright protection and plagiarism norms, but they diverge in interesting ways because of who is motivated to create and enforce them. So, I would point out that one kind of fundamental difference, of course, between copyright and plagiarism is, copyright is about what kinds of exclusive rights are granted in an original work of authorship by the government as a legal matter, right? So copyright is about law, and the scope of copyright protection is defined by the Copyright Act as interpreted by the courts. By contrast, plagiarism is norms are not law, right? I mean, they're sometimes kind of quasi-codified in internal institutional documents. But, those only apply to people who are subject to the jurisdiction of that institution, right? They don't apply to anyone else. Otherwise, broadly speaking, plagiarism norms are kind of expected forms of behavior within a community, and they're self-enforced, right? So there's a kind of self-help element to the way plagiarism norms work, right? You don't appeal to the government to enforce plagiarism norms for you. You do it yourself. And why is that? It's well, because among other things, plagiarism norms touch on practices that don't constitute copyright. So in a lot of ways, plagiarism and copyright protection can overlap. Like somebody might call it plagiarism to say, for example, copy an entire essay and then put your name on it, as opposed to somebody else's name, right? You've now copied without attribution. That would also be copyright infringement because the work is protected by copyright and you've copied it without getting permission. The difference is copyright doesn't actually care about attribution. It only cares about the copying of the work itself. So to the extent the work is protected by copyright, you're not permitted to copy it without the copyright owner's permission to copy it, but that copyright owner could give you the right. They could license you to publish it under your own name. In other words, they could kind of retroactively or even prospectively let you treat them as a ghostwriter if you compensated them in a way that they found acceptable. And copyright law will be totally fine with that. At least in theory, plagiarism norms would say it doesn't matter that they agreed to it. The only thing that matters is you failed to properly attribute the work in question, and you can't do that even though you have a legal right to do that. And a better illustration of that, for example, would be once a work falls into the public domain, right, it's no longer protected by copyright at all. So anyone can do anything they want to with that work, including republish that work with their name on it, right? So if I wanted to go out and publish Huckleberry Finn by Brian L. Fry, right, there's nothing legal anyone can do to stop me from republishing Huckleberry Finn under my own name. It's a work in the public domain. Anyone can do anything they want with it. It's not protected by copyright. But I think anyone who's invested in plagiarism norms would say that's very clearly a form of plagiarism. I mean, to the extent anyone would be fooled by my reattribution of the work to myself, right? So a little bit of an unrealistic example because of that, but I think nonetheless illustrative. And so why is that? Well, I would point to the origin of both copyright and plagiarism norms. And where did copyright come from? Well, you know, really the fundamental purpose of copyright was to protect the economic interests of publishers. I mean, this sort of proto pre-copyright law of England was, you know, a kind of quasi-administrative law developed by the Stationers Guild with the advent of printing and the reduction in reproduction costs of books and other forms of work of authorship. And all of a sudden, the publishers needed a way to kind of allocate ownership of the different works in question because it was more efficient from their perspective to have monopoly rights in particular works of authorship than to have each other competing over the right to publish identical or very similar works of authorship. And so it was really an allocative mechanism among publishers. And it really stayed that way. I mean, right, the Statute of Anne did say that copyright initially vests in the author, but everyone knew that the authors were going to transfer their copyright ownership to the publishers anyway. So ultimately, copyright ownership was going to end up with the publishers, and therefore, unsurprisingly, copyright ownership and the kind of the terms of copyright ownership at its origin reflected the interest particular to those of the publishers who cared about exclusivity in the reproduction and dissemination, the selling of the works that they owned, right? By contrast, authors in many respects, obviously they care about making money too, but authors are that much more invested in reputation and in a kind of ongoing attachment to the work that they generate, right? They don't just want to, you know, be able to control the economic use of the work in the marketplace for works of authorship. They also want to be able to control their own value in the marketplace for reputation. And that's true in spades for academics, right? I mean, you know, nothing matters more to an academic reputation than recognition as a important voice in a particular field. And so people really very strongly want to have that kind of attribution in a way that publishers are less concerned about. Well, I would suggest that's really the origin of plagiarism norms right there. And we can see that in as much as plagiarism norms long predate the invention of copyright law, right? I mean, copyright was pretty clearly a reaction to new technology, right? A reduction in reproduction costs. And it's, you know, it's developed and changed as technologies have changed as well. Well, plagiarism norms developed, I mean, the earliest expressions actually date back to classical Greece among philosophers, right? And we see a kind of flowering of the concept of plagiarism in Rome with Martial talking about, you know, like making fun of people for plagiarizing his poems. Well, why was that? And I think these were societies and moments in time in which reputation for intellectual product became increasingly valuable. And so the people who valued it were unsurprisingly looking for ways that they could maximize the value of this reputation that mattered to them professionally in the context in question. And I wrote a short article making a similar point about poets, monastic poets in 11th and 12th century Ireland, right? Again, because of the very peculiar nature of the economy of poetry at that point in time, attribution of poems was critical to maintaining the value of the reputation of any particular poet. And lo and behold, they ended up inventing their own set of plagiarism norms attaching to particular kinds of literary property. My hypothesis is that just as copyright has always been about money, about economics, in its own way, Plagiarism norms have always been about economics as well, just economics in a reputation economy rather than economics in an economy for the production and distribution of goods.
But if you can plagiarize a dead person, though, theoretically, and you're just going to assume that the ideas and norms within those works are not tropes, that they are worthy of attribution, then why? Protecting the integrity and the reputation of authors, which I can totally see for living authors. A dead author, or even for that matter, the estate of a dead author, isn't going to be harmed or besmirched in any way if someone takes their work and does not attribute it.
Yeah. Well, no, and that's a fair point, right? I would point to the fact that oftentimes estates of deceased authors are considerably more litigious than the authors themselves. So very frequently, the copyright litigation that you see is not authors litigating infringement of their own work, but their heirs fighting over who's going to get how much money and for what. I think there's an incentive, at least for relatively close relatives of deceased authors, to still object. I think my deeper concern would be that I think that there's a real truth to what you're saying there. Like, once somebody's dead, you know, we don't let them, you know, we don't let estates bring claims for right of publicity or defamation, typically, right? Why should we let them continue to assert plagiarism claims? Well, I mean, you know, I do think that there's some legitimacy to saying that in some contexts, it's beneficial to readers to know the source of a particular idea or statement, right? So my position on attribution is not that there's anything wrong with it. I mean, in fact, I encourage people when they're writing to attribute whenever they think it's appropriate and useful to their readers to do so. My only argument is that we shouldn't reify it, right? We shouldn't propertize that right and make it obligatory, right? It should be something done out of generosity and out of care to one's readers, not something done because somebody else can compel that attribution to happen in the first place. And I think that allowing attribution to become compulsory through the mechanism of plagiarism norms propertizes it in a really unhealthy way and encourages people to think of citation and attribution as a kind of quasi-property right that they ought to be enforcing aggressively, because if they don't, then in effect, they're getting part of the reputation benefit that they would otherwise experience, quote-unquote, stolen from them.
There was, I'm not sure if you're aware of it, but in the community that I'm in, you know, the comics and literature and pop culture community, mm-hmm. One thing people have been talking about a lot over the last couple of years has been the Omegaverse scandal, mm-hmm. And the plagiarism in that case, where, you know, you have one author who doesn't really at all understand how plagiarism or copyright is supposed to work. And she's going around and allegedly trying to get other competing works in the same category taken down. You know, there have been lawsuits over it, and it's been a huge to do on social media. And, you know, that got me thinking, though, because there come times where we have two people that believe they invented the same idea and used the same tropes, where you can look at these works and instinctively say, okay, well, these two things are very similar. And it could be easy out of context to say, well, yes, well, obviously, one was clearly drawing on the ideas and expressions in the other. But in reality, the reason for things like that is both authors sort of just come from the same universe. They live in the same culture. So naturally, they're going to have the same ideas. Is that a common thing that you see happening with these cases?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so in copyright law, there's actually a term that we use to describe precisely that phenomenon, which is scenes à faire, right? And this is a very old idea in copyright law, I think best expressed probably by Judge Leonard Hand in the 1920s, where he really points out that working in certain genres readers, consumers of the work in question, will come to expect certain kinds of themes and events to transpire. And therefore, in order to work in that genre, you need to be able to include those kinds of scenes and events and expectations in order for readers to recognize the kind of generic quality of the work in question. And I think that's very much what you're talking about here, right? People writing in and reading in these communities have expectations about what works are going to look like. They come to expect certain tropes and ideas to be expressed. And therefore, it's not so much that, I mean, yes, including those elements makes the work similar in certain ways, but it makes them similar only in ways that are universal to the genre in question. But I think that what the phenomenon you're describing also illustrates is the way in which both copyright and plagiarism norms operate or can operate as a kind of de facto method of competition policy enforced internally rather than for policy goals externally, right? In other words, it's essentially when this person goes around threatening others who are working in a similar format, right? What's happening is in effect an effort to eliminate the competition, right? I mean, you know, if you're generating a profit from working in a particular field, the best, you know, what you want to have as few competitors as possible, because all of those competitors are going to be alternative options for your potential consumers. And therefore, the farther you can keep people away from the product category you're creating, the more profitable your production is going to be. My take on it would be, if what we care about is maximizing value to readers, then from a copyright perspective, what we really ought to be asking is, would the readers of this particular category of works be inclined to see these competing works as substitutes for each other? Like, in other words, essentially the same thing, and they don't care which one that they buy. And I think that that's rarely the case. And frankly, I think that's rarely a thing that authors would want to say is the case in the first place, right? So every one of these people who's trying to assert exclusive rights to create books in a particular genre is going to say, well, I'm the best, right? And these other people are just copycats who are imitating me. They're not as good. I was here first. I'm doing a better job than they are. Therefore, they should find their own shtick and shouldn't be able to do what I'm doing. Well, my response is, do the readers know the difference, right? Can the readers tell the difference between your book and their book, right? Are the readers making a choice about which one they prefer? Then who cares, right? Who cares if they're doing something similar to you? It's different enough that readers can see the difference. And it's readers' preferences that that copyright policy, and I think kind of more broadly speaking, kind of social policy around the production of works of authorship should actually be caring about. And if what readers want are works that are in a similar genre, works that have a lot of commonality to them, well, that's great. And we should structure social policy to encourage the production of works in that way. And in fact, I think in many contexts we do, right? I mean, the reality is that people tend to like things that are slightly different from, but very similar to what they already know that they prefer, right? So, and anyone who makes music knows that, right? If you want to record a new song, right, you want it to be new and catchy in a way that people will respond to, but you don't want it to be so different that people don't know how to place it or aren't sure that they understand what you're getting. In other words, you want to have small changes that differentiate the work, but you don't want to have huge changes that are disconcerting to your consumers, because most people don't like that very much. And that's okay. People are entitled to like whatever they want. And I think we ought to be thinking about social policy in those terms, in terms of benefiting the public, not enabling producers to engage in any competitive conduct.
So do you remember there's a case around a song, speaking of music, called The Harlem Shake, mm-hmm. Which was very popular. In fact, it was so popular, it became sort of a meme on the internet. And it was basically just this mix of different funk tracks and a little bit of rock, and they added some lyrics to it, and it was a very compelling piece of music. There was another song with Justin Bieber called Esposito, which in the second case, there was never any legal, they did the same thing, but there was never any legal copyright infringement or consequences for the people that released the song. In the first case, there was a lot of issues over attribution, and I think it even went to court. I don't remember how it came out, but even the author of that work did not know what all of their sources were for the work. How do you feel about cases like that, where there's a lot of mixing involved?
Sure. Well, this is an area of real meaningful change right now in copyright law. So historically, not too long after the kind of the radical transformation of U.S. copyright law in the Copyright Act of 1976, which kind of reconceptualized copyrightable subject matter and how we think about copyright protection in some pretty profound ways, we had courts wrestling with the concept of sampling and the reuse of samples in new works. This was a really new phenomenon that courts didn't know how to think about. They were used to thinking about reuse of musical works or compositions, but the concept of sound recordings being independently protectable under federal law was relatively novel, and they didn't know how to apply it in this new circumstance or to these new genres. And so essentially, what many courts did at the time was to say, well, copying a sound recording is always infringing, no matter how short it is, because it's just a literal copy of whatever element of the song is that you've sampled a recording from. Well, I personally think that was a misinterpretation of the scope of copyright protection and the scope of the fair use doctrine, which doesn't include any exceptions for sound recordings, and so presumably ought to apply to sound recordings the same way it applies to any other kind of work of authorship. I also think it reflected a certain amount of perhaps sublimated prejudice, given that, you know, at the time, the majority of people working in with sampling were rap and hip hop artists who were primarily African American. That was not true of the judges who were hearing and deciding these cases. And I think a lot of them failed to properly appreciate the artistry and value that the authors in question were creating through the use of sampling. And at least, you know, for a period of time, commercial sampling became really difficult, really expensive. And I think it fundamentally changed the direction that certain forms of music ultimately went, because it wasn't commercially viable to engage in large amounts of sampling. If you're going to sample at R, you'd want to, you know, like, license a few small samples and then reuse them as much as possible, because, you know, licensing a whole slew of different samples would be way too burdensome in terms of negotiating them, and also way too expensive in terms of how much it would cost to actually obtain those licenses. Now, that's starting to change. Some courts have started to push back against this prior consensus idea that sampling was always per se infringing. And I think we're going to see more change on that front going forward, especially as I think at least some courts have become more receptive to the idea that this isn't actually a competing use of the work in question, and the lack of harm and actual potential benefit for the person whose work has been sampled is substantial, and therefore something which we should be promoting. And I would go back to what I said before, which is, you know, it's one thing to ask, how does copyright law actually work in practice right now? So if I put my lawyer hat on, I can make predictions, right, about, you know, when people are likely to legitimately think that they might have a viable claim, and how courts are likely to respond in practice if there's actual litigation. But if I put on my academic hat and talk about policy, I might give a really different answer about what we should be doing as opposed to what courts are actually doing. My feeling would be that, as a general rule, we should not have any limitations on sampling, especially sampling a large number of, a large number of works in a relatively minimal fashion, because it doesn't create a competing work. It doesn't create a substitute work, right? When people create these new things, audiences, listeners enjoy these new songs, not at the exclusion of the previous ones. And if anything, they may hunt out those previously existing works in order to appreciate them, right? So not only is there no obvious harm, there's, you know, the potential for benefit to the copied person, and there's the clear benefit that consumers derive from consuming a new work of authorship that didn't previously exist, right? So from a policy perspective, it seems to me that we ought to be much more open to these forms of copying, because the social benefits are substantial and the intercompetitive costs are really small, right? Now, of course, the alternative method would be to say, look, this is just all about allocating compensation. And, you know, should we really care about who gets paid how much? And, you know, allocating some to the sampled people, that's not a big deal, which is true, right? And if we had some kind of automatic mechanism of doing it, I would concede that, you know, it really is just all about allocation, and maybe we should be fine with a kind of more distributive system of copyright. The problem is that isn't how it works, at least not today. And the transactions costs associated with getting the licenses in the first place are super high, right? It's hard to negotiate licenses. And when you do, it's often, you know, the people you're negotiating with don't have an incentive to be reasonable and accept a market clearing price, right? So my preferred policy default would just be to say, to hell with it. They don't need that compensation in the first place, right? If the point of copyright law was to encourage them to produce the work initially, they clearly had an sufficient incentive to produce the work, and they weren't producing the work in the anticipation that it was going to be sampled and used in a new work. So they don't really need compensation for that in the first place. It's just gravy for them. Nothing wrong with giving it to them necessarily, but that's just a reallocation. The claim isn't really a moral claim at all. To my mind, it's just a claim that, well, because I've gotten a certain form of quasi-property protection, I ought to be able to assert it here as well as in any other circumstance. And my response would just be, why, right? This is just regulatory policy. That's it. And it doesn't seem like this is the kind of thing that we ought to be regulating.
Now, in both cases, I think you touched on something very, very interesting that I'd like you to speak on for a second. Do you feel that, just looking at this from the outside as a layman, as somebody who's not an expert, it seems to me that there is a lot of barrier here for young people, for people of color, for marginalized groups when it comes to this, that, older, more established, whiter people may not necessarily have. In these situations, am I crazy when I see that?
No, I mean, I don't think so at all. And I take this point, and I take the concerns that people have about this very seriously. I have a few different responses that I tend to make, right? Number one, and this is kind of the big picture one, when I think about social justice, I don't usually think more property rights, right? So if our response in other circumstances to concerns about equity and social justice is not what we really need is to develop more and stronger property rights in order to benefit people who aren't currently benefiting, and I don't think most people think that in most contexts, it's really strange to me to say that, well, there's something unique about cultural production where what we really need is more property rights. Because as a general rule, property rights tend to benefit incumbents, not marginalized people. And I don't see any reason to think that the same thing wouldn't be true in this context as it is in every other context. So I'm initially skeptical of the claim to look to property rights as a solution. To the extent that people are specifically concerned about plagiarism as negatively affecting minoritized people, I would observe that we have had plagiarism norms for a very, very long time, right? Plagiarism norms have not changed all that fundamentally in terms of how they're understood and how they're enforced over that period of time. If plagiarism norms were going to work magic in the area of social justice, I would expect them to have accomplished at least something already. And I really don't see a whole lot of evidence that they've worked very effectively. If anything, I hear the same, similar people telling similar stories over long periods of times, over a long period of time about injustices in relation to attribution. And then I would point to make a third point, which relies kind of on an analogy to other forms of intellectual property. So we've been talking about copyright law or ownership over typically, well, ownership over original works of authorship, but typically published original works of authorship, right? Copyright is like intrinsically tied to reproduction and publication. But there's another kind of right that we also talk about as a form of intellectual property, and that's trade secrets, right? And trade secrets are all about confidential information. So information that is kept private and not disclosed to the public. In my experience, most of the stories I hear about improper behavior around attribution and use of ideas, especially those affecting disenfranchised people, tend to be where somebody has disclosed in confidence a work or idea to a senior person in the hope that that person would offer them kind of some kind of benefit, right? So like a mentorship or advice or whatever. And then that person to whom they disclose in confidence turns around and uses the idea or the material, the data or whatever, without crediting the person who provided it to them. And that person doesn't feel like they're in a position to object, right? Because this person is more important. The response is going to be, you're a liar, whatever, right? And so what's the consequence of that? Well, they feel, you know, justifiably hurt because of the betrayal of confidence, and they're disinclined to engage in similar kinds of sharing in the future. That's has a at least a lot of parallels to what we talk about when we think about what trade secret protection is for, right? It's to facilitate people being able to share ideas in confidence with comfort that the trust that they've invested in the person with whom they're sharing will not be violated. I think that's something really different than what we're concerned about when we talk about plagiarism. And I think at least in my experience and observation, the practical effect of strong plagiarism norms is actually to work in the opposite direction, right? So, you know, what are plagiarism norms typically understood to require? Well, you have to attribute a idea or expression to the originator of that idea or expression. In other words, you have to kind of give the coin of the scholarly realm to the oldest, longest standing incumbent. Well, that's usually precisely the people who you know you're talking about. It's usually older white men, right, who've been dominating the field for a long time. So the practical effect in many respects of strong plagiarism norms is to actually entrench the people who are already entrenched at the expense of younger people who may have expressed similar ideas more effectively, right? But because they don't, quote unquote, own those ideas in the way the longer standing incumbents do, they're less likely to get attribution. And I think you can see efforts to kind of push back against that in things like, I don't know if you've seen, like there's a hashtag cite black women, for example, and a bunch of other kind of ideas kind of floating around out there to kind of be mindful and thoughtful about who you're citing and why you're citing to them. I think that that's a much healthier way of thinking about this issue than thinking about it in terms of plagiarism norms, right? The citation should be an act of generosity, to my mind. It should be recognizing the value of that which you're citing to and the importance of sharing that citation with the readership, not a sense of obligation to attribute to someone who's in a position to coerce attribution. And I think if we reformulate the concept of citation in that way, it might actually be really beneficial for people who otherwise find it more difficult to achieve success in academic fields as well as in other fields as well.
So when you have an author and they produce a work within academia, studying something or writing a piece, how does one judge objectively what merits a new expression of an idea or versus what is the original piece that the original author created? Are there any new ideas?
Well, I think the last bit is that's a tough question. I'm inclined to say not really, but there are sometimes interesting variations on old ideas. But I think that's a really tough question. I think it's one reason why the idea of idea plagiarism is kind of uncomfortable, right? So plagiarism policies consistently refer to idea plagiarism as being something that's prohibited. And yet it's pretty rare to see enforcement of kind of plagiarism norms, against people perceived as maybe not being as original as they could otherwise be. Now, that said, as I think I mentioned earlier, right? I mean, part of the problem here is that plagiarism is often in the eye of the beholder, and the beholder is often the person who feels aggrieved that they didn't get a citation. So there are certainly authors out there who view any discussion of an area of research in which they've written that does not include a citation to their work to be at best inappropriate and at worst kind of quasi-plagiarism because they should have gotten a citation. You know, this is actually not uncommon among academics. And a big part of the, reviewer two phenomenon, where you get back to peer review and it's just, a whole bunch of suggestions to cite to the reviewer's own scholarship. I think part of the problem with conceptualizing plagiarism norms as being about obligatory attribution is that, as I like to say, authors and academics see their own work everywhere they look, even if no one else can see it. And so, there's a real tendency for expansion and a kind of expansive idea of when attribution is necessary, irrespective of whether it's kind of necessary in an actual productive reader-oriented sense. My preference would be to really, at the very least, dial back this idea that ideas are something that people are entitled to own, right? I mean, there's a reason that copyright law says that ideas can't be protected by copyright. And I think that the same justifications apply to plagiarism norms, even though what they demand is only attribution, not exclusive rights to reproduce. I think I think it's still inappropriate and that people shouldn't be able to own ideas in that way either. But like I said, if we reformulate this idea of attribution as an act of generosity, I think we can then encourage a different kind of social norm around attribution and who ought to be acknowledged in hopefully ways that are more productive, more socially beneficial, and healthier for authors as well. Because I don't think that this kind of landlord mentality is a good way of thinking about artistic authorial production, right? I mean, not everything has to be property. And I would love to encourage less landlordism in innovation and in authorship.
Both the essays that you wrote that I was looking at were meticulously attributed. You had footnotes. But I did notice you had a lot, not only of attributions within your works, but you also did probably the most punk rock thing I can think of in that you listed them as being in the public domain. So you want people to take your work, not just attribute it, but remix it and reprocess it and repackage it, which I thought was very cool. Why take that extra step?
Right. Well, I mean, part of it is tied to my own interests in kind of challenging plagiarism norms. And so a lot of the work is essentially, it's kind of like academic trolling of of my own scholarly community by pushing at the boundaries of what's considered acceptable behavior and trying to do things that are unacceptable, but that people don't want to tell you why it's unacceptable because they don't actually have a really good reason, right? So like a recent paper, a short essay I wrote was called A Legal Scholarship Jubilee, right? And what I did in that article was I offered to reattribute all of the law review articles that I'd previously written to other people for free. And so I had a whole bunch of people who would write in and say, I really like this article. Can it be mine now? And I say, absolutely. I'm going to reattribute that article to you. Now, obviously, I can't actually do that, right? Right? Like, norms of my profession don't permit me to reattribute things to other people once I've already published them. But then the question is, well, why not, right? I mean, if I can ghostwrite them, am I allowed to ghostwrite them? Scholars don't like the idea of ghostwriting, right? But like, if it belongs to me, why can't I alienate it? Why can't I give it to someone else? I don't think anyone really has a good answer to that, other than that's like not part of our conventions. I love your comments about the footnotes, because Eva, I hate to break it to you, but among legal scholars, my work is considered wildly under footnoted by comparison to what other people produce.
Sorry.
Oh my God. Yes. No, I mean, the norms of legal scholarship are to include a citation to something at the end of basically every single sentence in an article. And frequently those citations will be long lists of papers that hopefully the author has actually read in the course of producing their scholarship. The cynic in me says that sometimes they're just lists and not necessarily something that was ever actually read in the first place. But yeah, it's not uncommon actually in many longer law review articles to see entire pages where there's no body text, just a whole page full of citations.
It's crazy.
You're preaching the choir on this one.
Is there really somebody sitting there just looking for an idea that wasn't attributed? I mean, it just seems like a lot of work, because even in your essays, mm-hmm. It seemed like going through and tracking all of that down. I mean, if I really, really wanted to, I guess I could, but just going through and tracking all those pieces down would be a lot of work. And if you've got a police, if you've got a body that does it, I have to imagine that, you know, there's one or more people just sitting in a room coming through every citation. And oh my God, that just sounds weird and unreasonable.
Yeah. Well, the norms of legal scholarship are weird, right? And part of that is driven by how legal scholarship is published. So unlike in other fields, we don't use peer review. Most law reviews are run actually by law students with, you know, no specialized expertise in any particular area of law. And so the kind of the form of legal scholarship does a lot to communicate to the law students making acceptance decisions and editing law review articles about the, you know, perceived quality of the scholarship, right? So, you know, one reason that legal scholars include a ton of citations is that, you know, the law students will look at the citations and be like, well, there's a lot of citations. This person did their homework. They read a bunch of stuff before producing this article. They must know what they're talking about, right? For another thing, the law students will often add additional citations if they don't think there are enough of them in order to, at least in their perception, I guess, make the work look more scholarly, which is very strange, but it does in fact happen. The other audience for those citations is, of course, other people in your field, right? Because law professors love to see other people recognizing their work. And so if you include citations to someone in your field in your paper, that'll make them happy, and it'll make them that much more likely to include citations to your work in their paper. So there's a kind of reciprocal quality to this, which I think has a tendency to kind of snowball into just ever vaster numbers of citations in legal scholarship, irrespective of whether or not those citations are beneficial to readers. You know, and sometimes they really are, right? I mean, like, you know, if students are interested in writing in a particular area, I'll often point them to a paper that I think is good, and then say, you know, and also look at the what they're citing to for different points. That'll be a good place to look in order to inform you better about the kind of bigger picture of this particular area of scholarship. Unfortunately, sometimes they get a little excessive, right? And it's not uncommon to see people kind of sticking in citations almost willy-nilly. You know, I mean, I like to joke that on multiple occasions, I have seen articles cite my papers for propositions that were either not even in the ballpark of what I was talking about, or actually the opposite of what I said in the paper. You know, but every cite is sacred, so you know, I'm not gonna complain, right? You can cite to it for anything you want to. but you know, there is a kind of excessiveness there in legal scholarship, but the incentives really push heavily in favor of like kind of copious attribution. And I don't see them kind of going the other direction anytime soon, unfortunately.
Do you do it because of tradition, or do you feel that you do it because it's useful?
I think I would say almost neither, kind of tradition, but really more institutional incentives, right? It's because of the way that the market for legal scholarship is structured as a kind of de facto matter. No one designed it. It just kind of ended up this way. But the kind of the built-in incentives have pushed legal scholarship in this really kind of unique direction in terms of the form of being, you know, much longer than scholarship in other fields and much more heavily cited than in other fields of scholarship. And you know, there's a certain element of tradition to that insofar as, you know, the law is a heavily precedent-based field of practice, and legal scholarship grew out of the legal profession, right? So, I mean, there is some level, I think, on which we're sort of acculturated to see citation as kind of being bolstering in the way that citing to a case would be in a legal brief. But I think it's also just, you know, it's very hard, like legal scholars are very, you know, cautious and bound to tradition. And it's very hard to sort of buck the trend and do things differently. And it makes people really uncomfortable when anyone kind of breaks the rules or doesn't do things the way that it's expected, right? So I just give like another really quick example. You know, the sort of traditional method of publishing legal scholarship is that twice a year, more or less, the law journals will say, oh, we're looking for new scholarship that we want to publish. And legal scholars will all rush out and send the new paper that they've been working on for the last 6 or 8 months out to the different law reviews. The law reviews will sort through them all and they'll, you know, make offers, and then scholars will try to bump it up to a fancier journal and blah, 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 blah. And that's really, for better or for worse, right, that kind of journal publication process can be highly, highly impactful on your success as a legal scholar, whether that's promotion within your new within your own institution or lateral moves to other more prestigious institutions. Many people in the field will say, well, that person published something in Harvard Law Review, they must be good. And that other person published something in Notre Dame Law Review, they must not be quite as good because Notre Dame isn't as fancy as Harvard. Therefore, Harvard wins over Notre Dame. Well, you know, I find that entire process really distasteful. So instead, what I've taken to doing is going on Twitter anytime I have a new article, and I just say, I have a new article, and whichever law journal wants to publish it, they can have it. Right. And
does that work?
Oh, yeah. It usually takes about 15 or 20 minutes and someone will make an offer. And I just say yes to whatever the first one is. But I think a lot of people in legal scholarship find that incredibly horrifying because it reflects a kind of really aggressive distaste for the hierarchy and the way we've kind of come to establish that hierarchy in the legal academy in ways that make them uncomfortable.
But on the other hand, it also shows, you know, that you're thinking outside of the box, you're forward thinking, you're looking ahead, you're trying to reach the most people possible. Why isn't everybody doing this?
That's right. But, you know, it's because the law is very conservative and very traditional, and people don't like change. They really, really don't like change. But I also feel like it's important to put your money where your mouth is, right? So there's a long tradition of people in legal scholarship, you know, kind of being iconoclastic and decrying the hierarchy and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, they usually do it from a position at a fancy law school, and they take full advantage of the hierarchy themselves. And so my feeling is, you know, if you're gonna criticize the way the profession is structured, you've got to have some skin in the game.
Awesome. Well, Brian, I wanted to thank you for your time today. I just had one more question for you, and this is totally off topic from what we've been talking about earlier. What do you read for fun?
All manner of things, really. I mean, I just read a new book by Robert McFarlane. He's an English writer who's really interested in language. His previous books, Landmarks, I really enjoyed. And this new one, Underworld, was all about the history of human activity underground, told through a series of anecdotes about his own personal experiences and caving and going into the catacombs in Paris and so on. Highly recommended. He's a great author and really kind of deep, profound book, something I really enjoyed a lot.
That's awesome. I'll have to check that one out. You know, I like to joke around that half the reason I do this podcast is to get reading recommendations from people.
Yeah, I'm also a big Raymond Roussel fan. So I have an article that I'm trying to finish called How I Wrote Certain of My Law Review Articles. So I don't know if you like Roussel, but Locus Solus is one of my favorite books of all time.
That sounds great. Well, cool. Brian, this has been an absolute pleasure. I feel like I learned something. I hope everybody listening learned something here. And, you know, I keep saying this has been the best show I've ever done. But this has been the best show I've ever done. And you have been absolutely awesome. And thank you so much.
Yeah, no, pleasure's all mine. Anytime, I'm always delighted to talk about plagiarism.
And that's our show. If you'd like to learn more about Brian Fry, we've posted links to his essays and appearances in other high-quality podcasts in the link description posted on the website and YouTube. Titular Characters is a podcast developed and produced by me, the adorable and endlessly delightful Eva Webb. This week's cover art was done by Luxiva, who is awesome. I love her. She's absurdly talented. The new bumper music is Superhero by Tim McMorris. Join us next time where we talk about superhero costumes with Dr. Comics, Jason Tondro. And that's it. Come again. And when you do, bring candy. Bye.